From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We are joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccan. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. And that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. Now, we've been opening at times with a Twitter roll call or a shout out on social media. Today, we wanted to do a very special version of that. And it's one that's timely and it's one that is important. So Blows of Mercy approached me on Instagram and I believe also called on the phone number. Is that correct, Matt?
Yes. This person left a message with a very similar message that she left to you on Instagram. Mm-hmm. I guess we'll just, let's call this person Blows of Mercy for now.
Yeah. And Blows of Mercy, I sent guys a screenshot so we could all be looped in before we were on air, raised a point that I think a lot of us in the audience have heard about recently, and it's a disturbing one. It's worth a PSA. We'll read this if that's all right. I think you guys have a copy of it too. Blows of Mercy says, "The xenophobia happening during this outbreak is really affecting my quality of life. I haven't been back to China since 2006. Not that anyone random would know, but it hurts to still be yelled at. Could you guys maybe just remind people that Asians are not the virus? We aren't to blame. The Chinese government screwed up. Not us. Hearing the attacks happening on Asians lately literally scares me for being me. People's lives are being upended, and I understand the outrage. It just sucks that it's been blamed on an entire continent. Thanks again." And, you know, have you guys been seeing some of the reports in the news about that here in the States?
Yeah, just like the kind of alarming uptick in racially motivated attacks and verbal abuse at the very least, and definitely seeing some people that are actually getting accosted physically.
Yeah, and this person, I called this person back and we had a brief conversation about this, but one of the things that they expressed was just the fear of going anywhere, stepping out of the house and looking the way you look just because of the way you look and being subject to this kind of discrimination. And then adding and compounding to that, wearing a mask the way, you know, we were told to wear a mask and the way that it's been recommended for us to do so, it just kind of adds to that. Yeah, it's definitely something we should be thinking about and just make sure we're not a part of the problem, right?
Yeah, and a lot of our fellow listeners and fellow conspiracy realists here aren't going to have that kind of lapse in critical thinking. You know what I mean? It reminded me a little bit about a few years ago. You guys remember the boycotts of Chick-fil-A, which is a tremendously popular chicken joint down here in Southeast United States, because of their anti-LGBT legislation and the enormous amounts of money that they would donate every year, people started boycotting Chick-fil-A, as is their right. And they started protesting it, as is their right. But there was this video that went viral of this guy pulling up to a Chick-fil-A drive-thru in a car and just screaming at this cashier who couldn't have been more than like 16. And he was saying like, "You did this and you hate people and you're over." And she's like so confused. She's almost about to cry. She's literally a teenager who's probably, I don't know, trying to save up for a video game console or a car. So I think that it's easy. It's a design flaw in the human brain that makes it so easy for us to project our big fears onto helpless people and onto innocent people, people who are in no way responsible. And it's not even like a left or right thing. But if you're seeing that kind of stuff in your neck of the woods, let us know, because we can guarantee you, if there is some sort of mastermind behind COVID-19, it's not the person that walked into Target in front of you. Like 100%, you have our word on that.
Well said, Ben. So thank you for writing to us and just making that point and calling and leaving that message and for speaking with us. So just let's keep that in mind as we keep going throughout this episode and as we keep living our lives.
Right, because we are, aren't we? We are living our lives. Here we are again, you know, hopefully one of your favorite conspiracy shows, mid-pandemic. We hope you're well. Matt, Noel, I hope you guys are doing well. Today we're looking at another crisis. It's a deeply disturbing and sadly somewhat obscure practice that continues to affect the United States and multiple other countries in the modern day. Think about it this way. What would you do if one day your government snatched your children away from you, kidnapped your children, for the express purpose of teaching them to forget where they came from and what their identity was? Just keep that in mind. If you have kids that you're close to in your life now, keep that in mind as we explore today's episode. Here are the facts.
So I think we all pretty much can accept the notion that European expansion really changed the world and made the world feel like sort of a smaller place, I guess. While Canada, the United States, and Australia are today considered part of the Anglosphere, ancient cultures existed in the American and Australian continents for millennia before the arrival of any of these interlopers. And the arrival of a lot of these outsiders completely changed the fabric of the cultures of the pre-existing native empires, which had been building for thousands of years in many cases.
Yeah. And this might sound like something from a dusty history book in some neglected corner of your local library, but history is alive, right? History is alive and it's reactive. And William Faulkner was right when he said the past is not past. The consequences of this expansion carry on to the modern day in numerous ways. And when we talk about the effects of the expansion here in the U.S., we can easily see the past through the current and frankly, the disturbing statistics. Like all we have to do to set the stage here is look at the statistics about Native American income, health, and education here in the U.S. And it's dire. It's improving now, but it's dire.
Native Americans are one of the most economically impoverished populations within the United States. And let's just look at the most recent year available when we're talking about income here. As of 2015, the median household income for a household that is identifying as Native American, it was $37,227. So that's median yearly household income. And you compare that with the nation as a whole, which has a median household income of $53,657. There's another thing here that we're, you know, it's changing as the day goes, especially as we're dealing with this new crisis. But Native Americans, in 2015 at least, have the highest unemployment rate, and it's 9.9% in 2015. That's the highest of any racial or ethnic group or identifying ethnic group within the United States.
And it's important to remember, we're talking about income because income is a powerful, income like education is a powerful predictor of health and life expectancy. And this income disparity has some pretty profound consequences for the health and well-being of people in the Native American population. This population also has a higher proportion of people who are living in poverty. 28.3% of people identify as Native Americans live in poverty, and that, you know, compare that to 15.5% of the total population. So it's outsize, you know, it's larger proportionally.
And just while we're on that subject of income and unemployment within Native American populations, I'd love to talk just briefly about this documentary that I watched in preparation for this called Little Dream Catchers. You can find it on YouTube right now if you search for it. It deals with a single population. It's in Minnesota. It's called the White Earth Nation, and it's a reservation there. And one of the main voices that you listen to in this is Irma J. Vizenor or Vizenor. I don't know how to pronounce it correctly. She's a former White Earth Nation chairwoman, and she's got a pretty powerful quote here talking about this subject.
During the Great Depression, when unemployment was 27%, there was an outrage in this country, and yet we have a Great Depression every day, year in and year out. Education is our ticket out of poverty here. 80% of a child's development takes place before 5 years old, so it seems to be a no-brainer to me to focus in that area. And like you said, Ben, that was from Irma J. Vizenor, former White Earth Nation chairwoman.
And I think it's a powerful quote, specifically at the end there, talking about how education is the way out, and that is going to play in heavily to this episode.
Yeah, that's astute, Matt. And this documentary is worth your time. Do check it out. Actually, there are a lot of like great examinations of this in academia and easily available on YouTube or online, but it still doesn't seem to get the attention that it needs to get. So remember that we're talking about education and how it affects health. So if we get to health, we see some other disturbing numbers. Unlike a lot of other what they would call racial or ethnic minority groups in the U.S., Native American populations have legal rights to federal health care services. And this is because of something called the Snyder Act in 1921 and the Indian Health Care Improvement Act of 1976. Together, those sort of like Voltron up and form the legislative authority for the federal agency that we call the Indian Health Service today. So one would think, if we just knew that, that there would be maybe better health in general in this population because of the guaranteed right to federal health care, which, as many people know, especially recently, most Americans don't have. So the problem is, this has not erased the stark disparities in health. Native American populations, including natives of Alaska, today have a life expectancy that's about 5.5 years less than all of the other populations of the U.S., however you want to slice them. That's 73 years to 78.5 years, respectively.
Another thing to note here, is that American Indians and Alaska Natives, so indigenous peoples, continue to die at higher rates than any other Americans in a lot of categories. And within this, you're going to find chronic liver disease, cirrhosis, diabetes, unintentional injuries, assaults, homicides, intentional self-harm and suicide, and chronic lower respiratory diseases. And that's not even to bring in the drug issues within these populations because of other socioeconomic issues that lead to a lot of these conditions.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same kind of things we see in a lot of impoverished parts of the country where, things like opioids take hold, or things like methamphetamines. You know, I mean, it's definitely more prevalent in areas that are economically depressed, because along with being economically depressed often comes being psychologically depressed, and people are looking for an escape, and these things can take hold and further ravage those communities. And we have another set of findings from the 2010 National Intimate Partner and Sexual Violence Survey that showed that relative to white women, Native American women are 1.2 times more likely to have experienced violence in their lifetime. And that relative to white men, Native American men are 1.3 times more likely to have experienced violence in their lifetimes. Really kind of staggering disparity there.
Mm-hmm. And when, we're pulling stats that are relatively recent, by which they're like, maybe 3 to 10 years old now at this point for some of these things. But we should note that the U.S. Census, if it is able to be completed during the pandemic, may have updated statistics to reveal. And there are tons of incredibly intelligent researchers and analysts who are working on this data continually. So we always love to hear the updates. All of this plays in. So income, health, all of this plays in concert with education. The U.S. educational system, this should not be a spoiler for anyone, has historically been a source of tremendous discrimination and, in a lot of cases, trauma for the Native population in North America and Hawaii. And even today, multiple reports will say that educational progress for Native Americans still lags behind that of other demographics. There was a report that came out from the in 2012 from the National Center for Education Statistics that said that Native American populations have the highest high school dropout rate in the country, and that was at 14.6%. But while these statistics are disturbing, and you should be disturbed by hearing them, you have to keep in mind they only paint a small part of the portrait here. Because you see, the effects of education on these populations have a secret history. They have a secret damning history. And it's one that a lot of factions, people in past administrations, a lot of people in government today, don't really want you to pay too much attention to. What are we talking about? We'll tell you after a word from our sponsor. Here's where it gets crazy.
So in the late 19th century, the United States government forcibly removed Native American children from their homes, shipping them off to different boarding schools in the hopes of assimilating them to the United States' culture. This was only one front in this culture war, which had begun long, long before that. The precedents were the idea of the forced assimilation that functioned in concert with forced removal from native land. It's the same way that the Minnesota Historical Society puts it. Quote, as white population grew in the United States and people settled further west toward the Mississippi in the late 1800s, there was an increasing pressure on the recently removed groups to give up some of their new land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is I like the way they put this here, because what they're saying is the governments had already forced these native populations to move away, right? If they're located on the Eastern Seaboard, like think of the Trail of Tears. And then in the late 1800s, they said, well, we've got more European descended people who want to branch out in this area. So let's get these people to move again. Now we want the land that we gave them earlier. In 1830, the U.S. forced Native Americans to move west of the Mississippi to make room for that expansion you mentioned, Noel, in what they called the Indian Removal Act. And then just a few decades later, Uncle Sam had a moment. I like to, when I think of supervillains like this, I like to think of them as dark light bulb moments. They had a dark light bulb moment, and they said, you know, what if we're running out of places to put these people? We're running out of places to kick them to. We have to figure out something else. And then another dark light bulb pops on, and someone says, since there's no more land to push them toward, why don't we make them like us? Why don't we pull, you know, the same kind of move the Borg pulls in Star Trek? Why don't we forcibly assimilate them?
This is really rough. This is really rough. I want to read another quote from that documentary I mentioned earlier, The Little Dreamcatchers. This is another quote from Irma J. Weisener. And she says, quote, historically, the purpose of education for us as tribal people has been assimilation. If we go back to the boarding school era of the 19th and 20th centuries, the purpose then, along with churches, was to eradicate tribal culture, language, and traditions, and to assimilate and civilize us, to Christianize us. So our children were taken away, over 100,000 in the boarding schools. The children were punished for speaking the language, the loss of language, the loss of culture, the loss of tradition, the loss of family, the loss of community. That brokenness is generational, and there's historical trauma attributed to it.
Oh, yeah, I mean, the idea of trauma passed down through generations has always been really fascinating to me. There's some kind of study that indicates that it can actually be passed down almost through genes, you know,
yeah,
through epigenetics. And that's fascinating to me on a whole nother level. But of course, it's going to happen just experientially, especially in this kind of situation.
Ben, you said it earlier, just the concept of someone coming in and ripping your children from you and taking them somewhere else and putting them in school. The dark light bulb moment, it, like, that they had there to assimilate them, but the way they chose to go about it here is just so heinous.
So how did this situation begin? How did we get from what we started to establish with pushing people out to what they're exploring in that quote? It really kicks into gear in the 1800s, in the late 1800s, in 1885, there's a guy named Hiram Price. He's the then Commissioner of Indian Affairs, and he explains the logic here by saying simply, quote, "It is cheaper to give them education than to fight them." In 1890, the U.S. government ended official open warfare against Native American tribes, and this was a very long war. It started in the 17th century, and it was exacerbated and reached a bloody height throughout the 19th century, and this had a terrible, terrible effect on the Native populations. We're talking about a huge group of unique, distinct cultures that numbered in the millions and millions of people, and now the population had plummeted to around 250,000. A lot of these communities were also confined to reservations, and those reservations were a little sliver of their traditional land. So what do you do when you want to get into the, quote, hearts and minds of a people, when you want to change the fabric of who they are? You start with their children. You always start with their children. And that's, that's why, at the risk of sounding crass, Wu-Tang is for the kids. Our species does this to each other because it has such a powerful effect, even when it's not, even when the effects are not what the instigators intended. So the goal became assimilation, to transform Native American populations into, quote, good Christian citizens. One school founder put it this way. It's a relatively offensive quote. It's the one that lives on in infamy. They said, "Kill the Indian in him and we will save the man."
Yikes.
Spooky stuff. Terrifying.
Yeah. So how did they go about attempting to kill the Indian? Metaphorically here, they started places like the Carlisle Indian School. It's the full name is the Carlisle Indian Industrial School. It was founded in 1879. It was a military barracks at one point that had been renovated. It was in Pennsylvania, and it was founded by Richard Henry Pratt, who is at the time when he's founding it, a captain in the Army. This place, the Carlisle School, it was the first federally funded off-reservation Indian boarding school. And it's definitely, it's the thing that it became the model, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we should note, too, that Pratt, who later went on to become a general in the Army, he considered himself somewhat progressive, and a lot of the people, a lot of the European American population that supported these schools also considered themselves progressive. They said they thought they were saving people. They thought they were working toward a greater good, and we know how that usually turns out. Carlyle said that he said something that sounds respectable at first. He says, "Look, Native Americans are equal to European Americans." And he says, the point of Carlisle School is to immerse these children. And again, these are children of different ages, immerse these children into mainstream European American culture. And then they'll be able to advance themselves. They'll thrive in the dominant European American society. And then bonus points, they'll return to their own lands, their own communities, and they'll become agents of assimilation themselves.
Which is particularly Borg-like, if you really think about it through the lens of it being a kind of pernicious thing that's being done, as opposed to this whole magnanimous lens of looking at it. If anyone out there wants an extra deep dive into some of this stuff, our sister podcast, Stuff You Missed in History Class, has a great episode about the history of Indian schools, just as a concept, and recommend that as a little bit, more of a, if you want to take this information a little further. So Carlisle's school became the model for 26 Bureau of Indian Affairs boarding schools in 15 states and territories, plus hundreds of private boarding schools sponsored by religious denominations. Over time, the school would become home to over 10,000 Native American children from 140 different tribes. And it was by no means the only one of its kind. Missionaries had been doing something similar for centuries, to your point, Ben, earlier, across the world, under that guise of saving people, saving the, you know, converting the heathens or whatever, the unwashed masses or whatever. I mean, this whole idea of we're doing you a solid, you should appreciate this. The battle for hearts and minds, really.
Yeah. And speaking of deep dives, there's a book on this we'd like to recommend. It came out back in 06. It's called Children Left Behind, The Dark Legacy of Indian Mission Boarding Schools by Tim Gago. So G-I-A-G-O. So do check that out. But do be warned that these are not pleasant afternoon podcasts or books. You know, you will probably not be in a good mood after you read them, and you shouldn't be. And I appreciate your point, Noel, about the scale of this practice, right? This battle for, you know, a culture has sometimes been described as the soul of a people. So in a metaphorical way, this is a battle for the souls of these communities. We want to pause for a word from our sponsor, and then we're going to return and give you a sense of the scale here and a sense of the day-to-day experience of these children. And we're back. So by 1900, this is still continuing. It was a spoiler, heads up, we'll tell you at the end, but this went on for much longer than a lot of people would think. By 1900, there were 307 boarding schools and day schools across the country. They educated more than 26,000 Native students of all types of ages, from all types of communities and tribes. The difference quickly between a day school and a boarding school is that a day school is what a lot of people grew up with, right? You go to school maybe 7:30, 8:30 or whatever. You get out sometime in the afternoon, you go home, rinse and repeat Monday through Friday. A boarding school is a little more intense because you live on the campus. You can't really go anywhere. And your parents have a much higher bar to access if they want to see you, to check on you, to make sure things are going all right. So we can see the extent of the practice here, but we have to ask ourselves, what did these schools, these institutions and their supporters actually do? How did they get the kids? How about that? Let's start with that.
Okay. Well, the first thing is that the school itself wasn't given some kind of carte blanche or something to act outside of the law to just go around kidnapping kids. They weren't supposed to be kidnapping children. And, you know, there were certainly some parents out there, you know, who knows how many numbers, there's no way to tell, but there were some parents within the Native American populations that did see it as an opportunity for their kids to both learn English, learn other skills that were going to be provided, you know, at that kind of school. And they saw it as a real opportunity. But there were a lot more people that saw this, these institutions, rather, and the people who were running them, they saw it as not schools at all. They saw it as a machine, a part of, you know, someone who came, a group that came along and took their kids and wanted to change their kids so they wouldn't be like them anymore. And we get this stuff from sapiens.org. That's sapiens.org.
Yeah, it's a really great article called Native American Children's Historic Forced Assimilation by Lindsay M. Montgomery and Chip Caldwell from this year, actually, from the 5th of March of 2020. And it's not to say that parents just allowed their children to be taken all the time. You know, there was absolutely resistance, as you could imagine, if you have a child or have, you know, had been charged with the care of a youngster. To have that child ripped away from you and taken forcibly would not sit well with most parents or guardians. But folks who you know, resisted were punished quite severely in the most cruel ways imaginable. Folks that were implementing these policies would hold back food rations, and families were already operating on razor thin margins of sustenance, you know, so to have that held over your head, I mean, that's a pretty, that's the equivalent of having a gun pointed at you. And that actually happened too. Oftentimes fathers who fought back were sent to prison, and in some very extreme cases, but not unheard of, there would be law enforcement officials who would literally kidnap these children while holding a gun on the parents.
So you don't have to be a lawyer to know that first things first, what does that mean? It means they were kidnapping children. Full stop. It means in some cases they were forcibly kidnapping children. And how do we define their mission? What they do with these kids? Well, it's similar to some of those quotes we had mentioned earlier. You could define it in two words. One, to civilize, and two, to Christianize. What I find interesting about that is there's not really at this time a difference. You know what I mean? Even the secular schools, like the ones that were state-supported and built in renovated military barracks, even those were still teaching children some version of Christianity, right? And, you know, they can be defined as much by what they did not allow children to do as what they did allow them to do. One of the first things you would do when you got there is you got a new name, and you could not use your name. You had to, you know, if they were like, all right, your new name is Norman or Janine or something like that, then you would be punished if you were like, no, my name is, you know, something different. And then the kids also had to get their hair cut, which is weirdly specific to what was considered a European-American style haircut. They were, of course, forbidden from speaking their native language. There are a lot of similarities with this and the Uyghur re-education camps that are currently still in operation in Western China.
Think about what that means, those three things that Ben just outlined there. Your identity, the person that you saw yourself as, the way your hairstyle reminds you of maybe your father's or your mother's or your grandparents, the language that is being spoken to you in your home that you've grown up with, that you speak much better than any other language, especially English, you are punished for speaking that. This is some intense psychological conditioning that's going on at these schools.
If I'm not mistaken, there's a really fantastic series on HBO. It's called Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee that was based on a book of the same name. And it was about just the conflict between, you know, like it was with Sitting Bull and all of that. And I'm almost positive that was sort of the last vestiges of truly tribal, you know, Indian culture in the West, kind of living out their lives as normal before all of this, you know, like reservations and stuff kicked in. I mean, they were still I'm sorry, I'm not remembering fully well what the story was, but there was a character in that film who was an assimilated Native American boy, and that it became a story point of his disconnect from the, you know, his people who were living, you know, as they had always lived for so many generations, and it became a very complicated thing for that character to kind of struggle with. Because on the one hand, he looks at his caretakers as being kind and positive and helpful and teaching him and giving him food to eat and all that. But then he sees that he's a little different and is having a hard time reconciling all of that.
I wanted to, if possible, bring in another quote here before we get into some of the even the more physical dangers that the children had to face in these places, if that's okay. It's just another quick quote from that documentary. And this quote comes from Barb Faber, F-A-B-R-E. She's the director of the White Earth Child Care Center there on the reservation. And in her quote is, "Many children were ripped from their families, loaded onto trucks, and not seeing their parents for years. We're talking generations where parents couldn't be parents. And so now you're seeing parents who maybe don't know how to parent because they did not receive parenting." And I think that really is a heavy concept to think about here, but just being taken away from your family like that, having your identity completely removed, and then going back home at some point and not really recognizing yourself or your immediate family because of the way you've been changed.
Mm-hmm. And that was one of, you know, that's the thing, like the old programming joke. It's not a bug. It's a feature, right? This was purposeful. And at this point, we don't want to be too incredibly graphic, but, you know, as you might expect, there was a wealth of abuse that occurred here, as well as death through neglect. There are multiple documented cases of physical abuse, of forced manual labor, of sexual abuse with children as young as 9 years old, and then, of course, emotional abuse. How could it not be an emotionally abusive situation for a kid to be forced to do these things? And many of those documented cases come from the church-run institutions, but that by no means is meant to imply that the quote-unquote secular institutions were any better. One interesting thing that bears thinking about is that due to the living conditions, these children were also exposed to diseases that could sometimes be fatal, like measles. There's this article in The Atlantic that came out last year, Death by Civilization, by Mary Annette Pember. And Mary Annette Pember is the daughter of a woman who was forced to live at one of these boarding schools. And in this, in her conversations with her mother, she learns, like her mother says, education was something that was done to us, not with us or for us. And one of the things that really hit home for me is that she described a culture of pervasive physical and sexual abuse at the school. Food and access to medical care were sometimes denied as punishment, and they were scarce to begin with. And because of that, whether through violence or neglect, many children died, and sometimes their parents, especially at the boarding schools, only learned that their child had died after the kid had been buried in a school cemetery, some of which, some of those graves are unmarked, I believe, today.
And done generally in the Christian tradition. So probably not in any way the traditions that have been used by the Native American families.
Yeah, and that can be a real deal breaker, you know, culturally speaking. I mean, that, you know, it's they would really truly believe that that individual's soul did not end up where it needed to go in the afterlife that goes along with their belief system. So in a way, it's a form of like psychological terrorism, you know? I mean, I know it wasn't looked at that way, but it is truly a absolute bastardization of people's most sacredly held beliefs. And it's just, I can't wrap my head around it. It's just a total myopic worldview that just bugs me in general. When people are so hung up on my way is the only way, no one else can have their own ideas, their own beliefs. That just really is one of my biggest pet peeves in of all of this kind of stuff.
Yeah, well said. This practice, again, is continuing in the 1900s, so into the 20th century. As a matter of fact, it was continuing less than a century ago. In 1928, this thing comes out called the Merriam Report. This is the first semi-comprehensive study of conditions for Native people since an earlier, I think, six-volume report that came out in the 1850s. So it's been decades and decades. And they are issuing a criticism and a condemnation of situations at these schools. One of the big things is they said, infectious disease is widespread, not just because of overcrowding, but because these kids are malnourished. There aren't good sanitary practices in place. The staff isn't keeping up what we would consider safety standards for a school nowadays. And the kids were weakened by overwork. Like at Carlisle Indian Industrial School, these kids were working. You know what I mean? They weren't just learning, being forced to learn scripture and stuff. Death rates at this time in these schools, according to this 1928 report, were 6.5 times higher than for any other group in the United States. And this this is where we get into maybe some conspiratorial territory, because you have to wonder how much of this was purposeful, how much of it was any of this like designed to slowly kill actual people instead of just their culture. Because so many contemporaneous accounts show people saying that they're coming from a progressive place, I think it's maybe just they didn't have the follow through. It seems like such an evil plan, doesn't it? It doesn't seem like a progressive plan. Maybe that's because we're in 2020, but they did see some benefits. You know, from Uncle Sam's perspective, one of the biggest benefits was the money. It was just cost effective. It's actually it's weird. It reminds me a little bit of the their argument is that erasing this culture this way through assimilation is less expensive for the bottom line than it would be to wage continual war against these communities, which is a brutal way to look at it.
Yeah, I would definitely say money had a lot to do with it. And you really only have to think about the fact that the model school was based in a barracks and started and led by, you know, a member of the military. And when you think about those two things, you either are going to fight these groups with ammunition and men who some of them will die, or on the other side, build a school that then stays there forever and can continually bring the children through, or at least forever in the minds of the people who are starting the program.
Well, let's call it what it is too. I mean, it is a militaristic forced camp, essentially. I mean, it's not a labor camp, but it is a camp of forced something. They're not forcing them to labor on behalf of the military, but they're forcing them to become a thing that then can be used later by the military. And it's even more pernicious because it's happening without these children's consent, of absolutely without the consent of their parents. And then they're turning them into a pawn in their, you know, their great game.
Yeah. Yeah. It's absolutely true. This idea, this incredibly cold, almost reptilian concept of the bottom line reminds me of another argument that we can make about the current prison system in the United States. Did you know, I don't know if people check, I know that we talked about this maybe years ago, but it is so much cheaper to send a kid to college than it is to send them to prison.
It's absurd.
Yeah, and the benefits to society are substantial and measurable.
Well, it depends on how you want your society to look, because that kid that goes to college becomes a weapon of change, a weapon of, you know, being able to bring other people into a better understanding of the situations that all of us find ourselves in. Right. I think you're drawing a line of comparison there with prison populations and perhaps, let's say, non-white people who are in prison. Anyone who finds themselves to be brown or black. We've talked about this, as you said, Ben, and it feels very similar to this. I'm feeling a lot of connections here to the modern day Nixon and Reagan stuff that we've talked about.
And by the way, I don't know who it was that said it, but somebody, a friend of mine, said during this COVID situation that we're dealing with right now, they need to just let all the low-level offenders just out of prison because they're essentially, you know, being condemned to potentially death from being in these prison populations and getting these diseases, this disease.
Yeah, I think I know for sure some countries have released exactly what you're describing. Your friends describing low-level prisoners. I think some, I want to say that some U.S. areas have done it, but I don't have confirmation. And I see exactly what you're saying, because for a lot of people, I don't know, it's weird. Like Harvey Weinstein managed to get special treatment in prison, right? Because of the COVID-19 concerns. Did you guys hear about that?
I mean, like he wasn't already going to get some special treatment, but it doesn't surprise me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he's so old and frail and like, oh, poor Harvey, you know.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. How do judges feel, you know, when they see people like that walking in suddenly on a walker? I don't want to sound cold.
No, it reminds me of the ambulance chasers who put a neck brace on their clients, you know, to get some goodwill points from the jury or whatever. It's such an old con that you'd think judges would just roll their eyes at it immediately, you know?
God, yeah. But yes, you're absolutely right. Your friend's absolutely right. The situation with the pandemic in prisons, it's a powder keg. It's waiting to explode if it hasn't exploded already. And there are riots happening over it here in the U.S. In prisons. So we talked about this, the benefits to the U.S. government for this practice, what they saw as the benefits. They thought, you know, just like we were talking about earlier, the idea was for the children to study there and then go back to their community and change. But this theory didn't account for the intense PTSD these kids would experience. It didn't account for how disconnected and alienated they would feel from their communities. It also clearly, it irreparably weakened the family structure. You know what I mean? Like imagine you're like an elder kid in your family and you get kidnapped and you're there for a few years. You survive. You come back and there are two more kids, right? And those kids, let's say they're both like four. They have no idea who you are. You're maybe a name that they've heard, but you've grown up now for years being forced to answer to Andrew or something, right? This is damaging.
Yeah, and not to mention the, can you imagine how powerless and just emasculated you must feel as, like, you know, head of the household? I say emasculated because obviously the head of the household, you know, in these days would have been considered the male, but... You know, the ability to not be able to protect your children, you know, well, that has serious psychological implications over time. And it leads to the kind of things we're talking about with the drug abuse problems and the suicidal ideations and just the generational mental health issues that go along with these communities. I mean, it really is a precedent that started farther back than even this, obviously. But this is sure is a biggie. You know, I can't imagine.
And now we want to answer the question that we alluded to earlier in the episode. When did this grim practice end? We haven't really talked about it. And that's because it wasn't until the late 1970s that Congress finally outlawed the forced removal of Native children from their families. 1970. Some of our fellow listeners are alive when that happened. The late 1970s. It's insane. That's just a few years before some of us were born. History is not over. And now, even now, like, it's understandable that historians are still working to gauge the full extent of the damage wrought by these programs, and they're still discovering bodies of children.
Yeah, on August 7th, 2017, the United States Army, same group that, you know, helped begin these schools, began exhuming the graves of the bodies of three children who originated from the northern Arapaho tribe. These three children died at that Carlisle Indian Industrial School in the 1880s. The children's names were Little Chief Horse and Little Plume. And those names were not the names that they were called while they were at the school. Those were their actual names.
Can you imagine being denied your name? I mean, we take it for granted, but it's such a, we live with it. And then if one day someone said, you're not Noel anymore, you're something else that I say you are. It's a powerful psychological tool to remove somebody's name. And it's the same as giving someone a number, you know, in a prison system or whatever. You are making them your slave, essentially, or at least at the very least, you are making them an other, and you are, like, you know, above them, and they are now your property, and you tell them what to do, and they jump when you say jump. It's really to do this with children is the thing that really it's just unconscionable.
I would say, yeah, I would say definitely with children. I think it's disgusting to do it with people. Like, if you give someone a nickname they don't like, or they say, don't call me that, you know, like, sometimes I'm very careful when I meet people to, you know, if they have a name that has a couple of common derivations, even if it's just a small thing, and when I want to ask them, what do you want to be called? Because sometimes people are so beaten down, that they feel like they don't have a right to have the name they want, which everybody does. You know what I mean? And yes, does it always work out for me? No, I met some guy in his 50s one time who wanted to be called like Snakebite, but that was his choice. And I'm not in charge of his life. So Snakebite, if you're listening, I hope you're having a great day.
We see you, Snakebite.
Yeah, there we go. We see you. And we know that this is a very, depressing doesn't cover it episode, especially because there are a lot of things here that'll never get solved. We'll understand more about the extent of the consequences and the fallout from this practice, but we'll probably never know the full extent, the full human extent of it. And we want to know what you think about this situation. Is there even more to the story? What discoveries are going to happen? If you are listening and you're not in the United States, have you experienced things like this, or do you know of things like this in your country or your region's past? If you are listening and you are in the U.S. and you have personal experience with this, what steps do you feel that the government has taken to address this, and do you feel those steps are adequate? If not, what should be done? We want to hear from you.
One thing I would like to point out here is that documentary that I keep bringing up, because really it's one of the main things that really touched me when I was prepping for this episode. There at the White Earth Nation in Minnesota, at the reservation there, one of the strategies they're taking is to use education to bring children of very young ages, at least introduce them and bring them back into the culture of their ancestors just a little bit, or as much as they can. So doing a lot of the old traditions, speaking the language and learning the language when in school. And, you know, for them, it seems to be having a very positive effect on this new generation, who will eventually be the leaders, whose parents maybe have had to deal with the immediate fallout to these schools and to the elimination of culture and tradition. So I would just say, I think that is one way forward, at least for some of the Native American populations within the U.S.
Well said, man. Thanks for ending us on a positive note today. As we said, or as positive as one could be in this situation, as we said, we want to hear from you. We hope this episode finds you well, regardless of where you live, and regardless of which room you find yourself stuck in today. Let us know your thoughts and speak with our fellow listeners. You, specifically you, are the best part of this show. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on Twitter, not just as people, but as individuals.
Yeah, if you want to find me, I am exclusively on Instagram at HowNowNoelBrown. As the cabin fever is setting in, I'm finding more random things to post. Made some tie-dye t-shirts with my daughter the other day, and that was a delight. And then we also made some homemade chapstick because the madness has truly taken hold, my friends.
You can find me, MattFrederick_iHeart, something to that effect. Good luck to you. If you can find it, you've won.
What do they win, Matt? What do they win?
You just win because you looked for something that you didn't need to, and you won't find anything new there, but you still took the journey.
You win a sense of accomplishment.
That's right.
You can also find me on Instagram. I'm at Ben Bolin. You can find me on Twitter at Ben Bolin HSW. You know, you can turn off the lights in a room with a mirror and just say some stuff a few times. We'll see what happens. Schedules are busy. If you don't like to mess with social media, boy, do we have good news for you. We have a phone number.
Yes, it is 1-833-STDWYTK. Give us a call. Leave a message, and we will be listening to it. We've all got the login. We're all in there now. It's not just me anymore. And we've been downloading a ton of messages, writing out who you are, what you've said. We're pretty excited. We're going to be diving into it pretty soon.
And if you don't want to do any of that stuff and you just want to, you know, communicate with us the old-fashioned way, no, don't send us a letter. You could if you wanted to. We don't really give out a mailing address. You could find that, though, if you really did some digging. That'd be another fun scavenger hunt for you to do. But you can send us a good old-fashioned email. We are
conspiracy@iheartradio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.